You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. And it's October, but boy, it's certainly warm for October now.
Today is October 2nd, 2024, as Lois and I are preparing this show for broadcast on October 3rd, 2024. And today's high, according to the National Weather Service, will be 101 degrees. That's right, October 2nd, 101 degrees. Yesterday, October 1st, we hit 100 degrees in Davis at 4 p.m., and Vacaville was 102. So we're having some relatively high temperatures for this time of year when you consider especially that our average high right now would be 82, really? Okay, that's what WeatherSpark says. So we're running 19 to 20 degrees above average right at the moment. Somebody said, isn't this the latest we've ever had 100-degree weather in Davis? And in point of fact, it is not the latest we've ever had 100-degree weather in Davis, but it's going to be a hot week. The latest date of 100-degree temperatures, I had to scour around to find this, but I knew it was a little later in the month. October 11 is the latest date that we have recorded 100-degree temperatures in Davis, and that was in 1991, I think. So it was a while ago. We're going to be warm all week, it looks like. Folks, if, remember, I just said the average high right now. Did I just say 82?
You did.
Average high in Davis. Let me make sure that I'm looking at the right place, because that doesn't seem right. Yes, October 2nd, the average high is 82 degrees. Coming up this week, it's going to be 97 on Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 95 on Friday, 95 on Saturday, 94 on Sunday, 90 on Monday, and 87 on Tuesday. So at least 5 degrees above average for the entire week. Night temperatures are going to be unusually warm for this time of year. 59 tonight, 60 degrees Thursday night, 61 degrees Friday night, 60 on Saturday night, 57 on Sunday night, and ooh, people are going to be shivering, 54 on Monday night. Mom's cold, wear a sweater. So we've got no rain, no clouds, mostly clear, they say, and I don't see any sign of clouds or anything on the horizon. With warm temperatures, you know, this is something that many of us who have lived here for a while are accustomed to, is very warm in September, and of course, all the way into the second or even third week of October. But we are a little even warmer than that. So 101 degrees today.
Would you consider our 2 days of over 100 to be a heat wave? How many days does it take to be a heat wave?
Sure, that's a heat wave. I don't know. At this point, to me, a heat wave is like 7 days, 20 degrees above average. Because of the kind of heat waves we've been experiencing in recent years. A lot of data coming out about how the summer wound up for Sacramento and Davis. We'll go over that in another show, what kind of summer we had. It has affected how people did with their vegetable gardens, that's for sure. It's really funny, the range of comments that I get about, how'd your tomatoes do this year? Some people are, oh yeah, best year I've ever had. I got them in about 1st of May, and my experience was lots and lots of tomatoes in July from set that happened in May and early June. And then a sort of a long gap because of the high temperatures through the month of July. Very good fruit set in August, and I'm still picking bowls, and I mean bowls of tomatoes from certain varieties. And this is where it's really handy for people to swap notes. If you're in the Davis area, there's a gardening and homesteading in Davis group where people are chatting about this right now, about which
ones on Facebook,
well, right? On Facebook, yes. Which ones did well, which ones did not. And that's the kind of information we really, you know, I really wish someone of us could put in some kind of central crowdsourced repository of information about all these varieties, because some of them did exceptionally well. Some of them did very poorly. And many people kind of gave up. This is the problem part for some people. It was getting so hot in July. They weren't setting a lot of fruit because of the high temperatures. So they thought, okay, season is over. I'll just stop watering, or I'll keep trickling water on them and see what happens. Those people did not get good results. But I have a number of varieties out there, 10 in particular that I'm tracking, that have 30 to 50 fruit ripening on them. Those 10 that we're picking now and we'll be continuing to pick for 2 to 4 more weeks. So those varieties I'll definitely make note of and definitely keep, you know, mentioning to people. And then some that did not do very well, and hate to say this, that skews towards the heirlooms in that last regard.
So I want to be excited again. We have our 20th anniversary. Catert has turned 20. We told you that last week. And we're going to have a party. And y'all are invited to join us. We will be having a party on the 18th of October. That's a Friday. Start at 6 p.m. We'll have fun being partying. And there's going to be music. So the live music is from Cowboys After Dark and from Max and Julian from the Big Poppies. So I hope you enjoy it. Friday, October 18th, 6 p.m., Sudworks.
Sudworks is at 2001 2nd Street, and this is an outdoor venue.
The other thing Don sent me was a list of the upcoming plant sales at the Arboretum. Now, most of you have heard of us talk about the Arboretum. It's part of the University of California at Davis campus, and they have members, that is, friends of the Arboretum, and you can become a member. You can join. If you are a member or you join at the door, you can come to the October 5th sale.
Oh, that's this Saturday. That's,
yeah, if you're listening to our show, it's at exactly the same time. But it goes to 1 p.m., 9 to 1, so you still have a little time. Saturday, October 5th. And then there will be more. There will be two more later, Saturday, October 26th. And Saturday, November 16th. We'll tell you more about those later.
I also want to mention that Warren Roberts, the retired superintendent of the Arboretum, has resumed his Walk with Warren. These are always very entertaining. They're on the third Wednesday of the month, at least October and November. So October 16th and November 20th, that's at noon. You meet at the Shields Gazebo, which is down at the West End. Right near the Arboretum Teaching Nursery there. You can't miss it. It's near the large animal clinic at the UC Vet Center. Walk with Warren. He knows so much about plants, it's almost disturbing. Plus, he has great, great sense of humor. I highly recommend going on a walk with Warren if you have the opportunity. So at least October, November, third Wednesday. This information, by the way, is available at arboretum.ucdavis.edu, and just click on the events link.
Last week, if y'all listened to the show, we were talking about Australian plants like grevilleas and bottle brush. And Don mentioned that, well, they have all these hummingbird attracting plants, but there's no hummingbirds in Australia. I wonder what kind of birds they have that act like hummingbirds over there. Well, I, of course, went immediately to Macaulay Library. And if you folks haven't been there, MacaulayLibrary, Macaulay Library. And it's a place where there's pictures of birds that people have taken. So if someone goes out and they're, you know, going bird watching and they write down everything they saw and they got a picture of one of these birds that they want to add, they can put it with their list, and that will automatically get added to the Macaulay Library database, which is incredible. So I just searched for Australian hummingbird, and that happens to be the common name of a thing called an Eastern spinebill. I got the picture up. I showed it to Don because we're on Zoom and we can do that. And Don, what is the plant that it is hanging on to upside down and drinking from?
That's a grevillea. which we mentioned frequently. Grevillea is an important genus of shrubs. There are 400 or 500 species and cultivars of Grevillea all over the continent or island of Australia. And the flowers are a fascinating structure, and they look as if they were designed for a hummingbird. So if I were Charles Darwin, I'd be looking at this flower going, somewhere out there in the Australian bush is a bird with a long, narrow beak. Can go in here
and slightly curved.
Slightly curved to get at the nectar reward that's at the base. Many flowers have a nectar reward right near the ovary, and frequently in the process of going in to get that nectar reward, the bee or the butterfly or the hummingbird brushes against the pollen that's up further on the flower. And if you see, you know, bees flying around, you'll often see pollen in weird places on them because they've inadvertently picked up the pollen from the flower. So the nectar reward brings them in, and then they fly away with pollen for the next flower. And this bird looks like a giant fat hummingbird.
it's got a longer tail. And it's a more plump than the hummingbirds. Hummingbirds tend to be sleek, and it is quite big. It's at least twice as big as a hummingbird. It has, it doesn't hover, but it can hang upside down on the flower in fluorescence. And when I was looking through the pictures and skimming through the pictures, there were a lot of pictures showing this bird with yellow pollen on the top of its head.
On their head. They bumped into it inadvertently. Yeah. Grevilleas are a great group of shrubs for California gardens. Probably, let's see, in the 1970s, nurseries in California started importing and selling Australian shrubs because their climate in many places is very similar to California's climate. In fact, they have the same range of climate that California has. They have cold regions, dry regions, subtropical parts like Queensland and so forth. And grevilleas were some of the first things they brought in. And interestingly, they were kind of a disaster. They brought in Grevillea noelli, Grevillea canberra, a couple of other cultivars that had become very popular in Australia, and we would sell them. And in Davis, in particular, they would get really anemic. They would yellow right away. The new growth would come out looking very unhappy. And we just gradually, and they were about as easy to overwater in some cases as our California native plants because they were adapted to a similar dry summer, wet winter climate. So they're a little vulnerable to Phytophthora crown rot. We found that we just couldn't sell them very well. So we all kind of backed off. And then I learned a really important data point about grevilleas way back in the 1980s. They're sensitive to phosphorus. And so the standard practice in California, in our nursery, you know, when we open, we
have like
Sure Start. We had these fertilizers that it was standard practice to turn into the soil as you backfilled and plant into them to give them a little boost, you know, Sure Start. That name just tells you right there. And they tended to be high in phosphorus. This was based on the old, disproven, but the old theory, or I won't even call it a hypothesis, the old belief that phosphorus somehow stimulated root growth. And there are other things that were claimed for phosphorus, but it was a standard thing to add it to starter fertilizers. And so we were putting in something in the root zone
to poison the plant.
It was actually too much. Yes, these are many places that they come from. There are not naturally large amounts of phosphates or phosphorus in the soil. And so these are plants that have adapted to extracting what they need by means of very fine root hairs and that have a strong mycorrhizal association that allows them to intake phosphorus. And if you put some down in the root zone, it's way too much. It burns them. A normal plant, if you will, would be fine. It wouldn't hurt it. We know that it doesn't really help now, so we've stopped selling those types of things, but it would hurt some plants. And we quickly learned that that was probably the major factor. We were blaming the pH of the water. We were thinking it was the density of the soil. Well, there's places in Australia that have very high pH water. There's places in Australia that have very heavy soil, and grevilleas are certainly native there. So it turned out that it was just excess phosphate. Basically, these are plants very well adapted to poor soils and very well adapted to long periods of drought. And they bloom typically heavily in the winter and spring. And they're all attractive to hummingbirds, certainly birds that are native to Australia as well. So they're great plants for our landscapes here in California.
Well, let's get to our mailbag. We have a listener named Braden who writes, "The short version of my question is that I'm looking for gloves that I can wear while weeding that protect my hands from spiders and sharp objects, but allow enough tactile sense to differentiate weeds from other plants and feel how hard to pull them to get as much root as possible. The long version is probably too much information, but sometimes you two have a different way of looking at things, and so I will Tell you, I
Okay.
live in woodland and have a small property that is densely planted with food, flowers, and trees, both in the ground and in containers, as well as some lawn spaces. I find it easy to keep my containers weeded, but the garden beds tend to get quite overgrown with two types of grasses in between weeding. I've never been able to positively identify these grasses. I believe they are Bermuda grass and some type of nutsedge. These weeds are very well established in my garden beds and grow in between and through all my other ground covers and plants, making their removal a delicate process. The Bermuda grass isn't too bad because the stolon is pretty strong, so as long as the ground isn't too dry, I can usually get nice long lengths of it out at once. We'll come back to that point. The nutsedge, on the other hand, is impossible. The individual plants break off the rhizome so easily. I've only managed to get more than one connected plant from extremely soft soil with a very gentle touch. Usually, I just get very few roots and no rhizome or tuber. I've been ordering gloves, leather over the hands, thick cloth covering the forearms, but when I wear them, my touch is so insensitive I can't even that I do even worse with the nutsedge. After leaving a little leaf along with all the underground portion, I also sometimes pull up desirable plants, thinking that I'm holding nutsedge. My fingers can feel the difference, but not with the gloves on. So, for that reason, I prefer to weed barehanded. I've occasionally grabbed sharp things and believe I have gotten some insect or spider bites while weeding as well, though nothing serious. Today, I found a large female black widow after clearing a large area of nutsedge barehanded. This reminded me that I should probably be wearing gloves. Is there a better way that I should be controlling the nutsedge and Bermuda grass? Thanks for your advice and your informative show. And he has some pictures.
Yeah, great
So,
pictures, because this is definitely
great picture.
nutsedge in this main picture here, and the other one does look like Bermuda grass, two of the most difficult weeds. Well, let's get back to the glove thing first. I over the years have gotten to the point that I wear gloves all the time when I'm gardening, whether I'm handling soils or pulling weeds or whatever. The reason being many things cause dermatitis. And so people who are working in the garden suddenly get itchy skin without realizing where it came from. And it's because some plants cause dermatitis, some of the soil amendments that you buy at garden centers cause dermatitis. And yes, there are things out there that could bite you and sharp things in the soil. Those are less of a concern to me, actually, than the things you're pulling. I had a fellow horticulturist who pulled down a whole bunch of morning glory vine one time, the perennial one, just spent an hour pulling it all out and then got a serious headache because the juice of that vine is somewhat toxic and she hadn't been protecting her hands from absorbing the material through her skin. So there's good reasons to wear gloves all the time. We sell a brand of gloves at our nursery, and it's the only brand we sell at this point. It's Atlas gloves, nitrile coated. They're nitrile on the palm part of the hand, and they're cloth on the back. And we just stopped carrying everything else because this was all anybody at the nursery was using. We find that they are supple enough that they do allow you to feel roughly what you're doing, but the nitrile coating protects you from things poking into you, even including rose spines if you use them carefully. I mean, you can gr slowly grasp a rose cane before you prune it, and it won't push through the nitrile. If you grasp it fast, it will. So you'll quickly learn to be a little more gentle and move a little more slowly. But Atlas brand nitrile coated gloves are very effective and reasonably supple. I am going to emphasize, I strongly recommend not gardening barehanded. Strongly recommend it. Dermatitis, spider bites, things like that happen to everybody. Now, being concerned about black widow spiders, they aren't aggressive. And black widow spiders are found in dark areas. They mainly feed on other spiders that happen to come near their web, and other things, of course, but they're actually pretty good predators of other spiders. And you'd be surprised, perhaps disturbed, but surprised to learn how many of them you're actually living with at any given time around your house and around your yard. They're out there, and yet you don't encounter them until you go to move that pile of firewood that's been there for a year, until you go to pick up the kids' toys that were over on the side of the yard for 6 months and that didn't get disturbed. They don't like to be in disturbed areas. They don't like light. So that's the first thing. I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I'd be more concerned about getting stung by something in the garden than being bitten by a black widow. It's the injury from plants. And in the nursery industry, we know that there are many plants that cause skin irritation. Alstroemeria, azaleas, just two right off the top of my head that can cause pretty serious skin irritation, and it varies from one person to another is the other issue. Some of us are more sensitive than others to particular plants. So just to be cautious, I keep a pair of nitrile coated Atlas gloves, extra large, right at the side of my desk. And when someone needs me to walk out in the nursery with them, the first thing I do is grab those gloves and put them on and walk out. And part of that is because I may be lifting soil in their car for them. I might be lifting container plants. I might be grabbing something, a plant that I know is possibly irritating to the skin. I can't possibly keep a list of all the plants that do and don't cause skin irritation. So it's just a good precaution. And in this particular instance, I think you'll find these grip well enough. They'd be adequate for what you're doing. Now let's talk about the weeds you're dealing with. Laura, first, go ahead.
Okay. Nutsedge. I want to talk about nutsedge.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've had nutsedge in our place. What I have figured out, and this was over talking to Don and years of experimentation, is that once it's up and an adult, you're out of luck.
For that year,
you go to pull it and it just breaks off and leaves the nut behind and it sprouts next year.
It leaves eight nuts behind.
Let's talk about the life cycle of the nut. You get a little nut that's from the previous year, and there's a little nut in the ground. It sprouts up. You get one or two thin little green leaves, and then as it is growing, it thickens up, and then at some point, it starts making nutlets out of itself. If you, in the spring, go and pull up that little two or three leaf thing, odds are high that you'll get the nut with it. Or if you don't get the nut with it, will have expended all of its oomph into that thing and probably won't come back, that one particular nut. But if you can do that in the spring, when they're young, when they're new, the soil is usually moist, and it usually not as hard as it is later, and not as futile as it is.
Yeah, it doesn't feel as futile. Yeah, it's a good rule. One of our aphorisms here at the Davis Garden Show: most weeds are easy to control in the 4 to 6 leaf stage. And if you get them in the 4 to 6 leaf stage, you're actually controlling them. In the case of nutsedge, once you get past that, it's forming nutlets at the end of the roots. And so each plant you pull has 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 nutlets left behind. So pulling it, in fact, doesn't accomplish anything. But as Lois says, 2 to 4 leaves, you can see them. They're very recognizable. And if you loosen the soil, this is where a spading fork can be incredibly helpful. You just stick it in the ground and loosen the soil and then tug at the 4-leaf stage or before, maybe as late as 6 leaf, then you'll actually pull out the whole plant and you'll actually get control. Past that stage, you just bury it. You just keep burying nutsedge. You go over to Lois's house and you get some of those arborist wood chips that are still in her driveway. And you put 6 inches on top of the nutsedge, knowing, just for the record, full well, before someone jumps up and down and says, they'll get right through that. Some of them will get right through that. You bury them again and again and again. Some people use landscape fabric, but that kind of blocks air and water from getting in. So just mulching during the growing season, pulling in the spring, is your best medium-term strategy. In the long term, nutsedge doesn't grow well in the shade. So if you're putting in big woody plants, I noticed the picture has a citrus tree, for example, it'll eventually shade out the nutsedge. And honestly, nutsedge under a citrus tree isn't that big a deal. It's not really competing with a tree once it's 3 or 4 years old. So you don't really have to worry that much about it. And gradually it will thin out. It's a very, very, very persistent, easy multiplier. My father had it show up in his vegetable garden and began pulling it. And he said, seems like it's just increasing when I pull it. I learned later when I took weed science, actually, Dad, that's exactly what's happening. You're waiting too long to pull it. You need to pull it out earlier in the season. And in a vegetable garden, it can be very challenging, at least with, you know, smaller plants like peppers and things, because it will choke them out. So pull early, smother. That's your best long-term strategy. And then ultimately shading it out with a woody plant.
If you can't shade it right away, I mean, if you can't mulch it right away, you can take a string trimmer, one of those little whirly-do things that has a string on it. I would say carry in your other hand a spade or something so that you can put that in front of the plant you want to keep while you're stringing it and you're not cutting down your peppers or anything. But once you cut that the top off. Now, it's still there. It's still going to grow back, but it's not looking at you right then. And the other thing is
that you feel like you're accomplishing something.
Yeah, you do. And the other thing is, you know, it's a pretty little grass.
Oh, come now.
If you did not know that it was hard to get rid of, you probably wouldn't be as excited about
it. I've had some very amusing conversations about nuts edge with people. My favorite line was from Pam Bone, her longtime urban horticulturist, very active in the Master Gardeners program in Sacramento. When asked what she would do if she had nuts edge in her yard, she said, put the house on the market in the winter.
Move.
Because nuts edge is dormant in the wintertime. Another one who asked me, it's in my lawn. What do I do about that? In your lawn? Well, first of all, okay, there is a selective herbicide that will kill nuts edge in turf. So you know that if you're growing a lawn of any kind and you have nuts edge, yes, there's a product out there that will kill it. It gives about 90% control, and big turf management company, you know, the companies that do golf courses and things like that make use of this. They manage it that way. So it just won't choke out the turf because it goes dormant in the winter. So you'd have these big bare areas. And I was talking with one customer who was looking for a lawn alternative, but she had nuts edge. And I said, well, nuts edge itself is not a great lawn alternative because it's gone in the wintertime. But there are sedges that are used as lawn alternatives, including some native sedges. And, you know, frankly, the nuts edge would just blend with them when it's growing in the summertime. So, you know, maybe that's what I would do. And bear in mind, some of those sedges that are being promoted as lawn alternatives are just as hard to get rid of as nuts edge if you change them later. But I think your best approach, recap here, pull early, smother, repeat. Okay. that's the nuts edge.
Then let's talk about the Bermuda grass, because you made a comment that, boy, you can get a big, long thing of that at once. Well, you can. That's because it grows so fast. So the Bermuda grass that you find running along the top of the ground is easy to find, is easy to pull out. The Bermuda grass parts that are under the ground are not so easy to find or pull out. And if you break them off, well, each one of those little broken off bits will sprout up.
One of my main jobs as a teenager gardening in my neighborhood, as the only teenager who was willing to do so, so I was in high demand, was digging up Bermuda grass. This is long before there were any well-known herbicides that would kill Bermuda grass. So basically what you did was you dug it out. You soaked the ground very thoroughly, a day or so ahead of time. I mean, really thorough soaking, a foot or so deep is what you're aiming for. So an inch or two of water. And then you wait till the soil isn't that muddy. And again, that spading fork was incredibly useful. If you don't know what a spading fork is, it's not a pitchfork. It kind of looks like when it has flat tines instead of round tines. You push it straight down and you pull it back and forth to loosen the soil. And then you can take that glove-coated hand and reach down and grasp some chunk of the Bermuda grass and tug up, and it pulls right up. So I got really familiar with the growth habit of Bermuda grass. Most of what we're dealing with in California is actually hybrid Bermuda grass, not common Bermuda grass. It was introduced as a great lawn in the 40s and 50s with the expansion of suburbs all over Southern California and Northern California. It became a very popular turf because it is indeed very well adapted here in California. It doesn't seed. Isn't that good news? It doesn't seed. It's sterile, basically. Bad news is that any little piece of the stolon will root as long as it has a node. And so lawn mowers can inadvertently carry it from one yard to another. That was happening pretty commonly. And now it's one of our most common and most difficult to control weeds. It is a very attractive turf. I frequently have recommended that people who have it as a predominant part of their turf, if it's an active turf with kids and dogs and stuff, go ahead and just keep it, use it, and, you know, just seed other grass into it so you have a nicer looking lawn in the wintertime. But when it's invading your garden borders, I can tell you from experience, it runs 3 to 4 feet in a season. Those stolons can run across the ground. Good news, you know, despite what Lois said, good news, it rarely goes underground. It can, but it rarely does. Usually goes like bamboo, right across the surface. Happily in leaves or grass or whatever, so you may not see it happening, but it's running across the ground well ahead of where it's rooting. So I found that the customer and I had decided on this is the line of demarcation where Bermuda grass is not going to be allowed to continue. We would go along and cut that with a lawn edger. There's mechanical devices, and I could frequently just start pulling the stolons, which hadn't even rooted at that point. If you wait, Till the end of the summer, they're starting to root. The next year, not only are they rooting, but new shoots are coming out at each point, each node, and those are going to run out generally more or less at right angles to the stolon that first went out. So now you have a whole bed full of it filling up pretty quickly. And by the third year, you have a bed full of Bermuda grass. So much like running forms of bamboo, it takes a while for it to completely take over. But when it does, you have a much different challenge on your hands. Here it looks like it's running into the garden beds. So as you've probably found, you can tug it out, you can tug out the part that's just run in pretty easily. Keep in mind that spading fork, because that was one of my most useful tools as a teenager, was to loosen that soil so I could pull out the main part that had started the process of invading the bed. And you just keep after it. There are, of course, various well-known herbicides that do work on Bermuda grass, but most people aren't really wanting to use those in their vegetable gardens. So the same principle applies with nutsedge. You can smother it. You can bury it. It will come through. You can keep doing that. But in the case of the Bermuda grass, it doesn't even really start growing until late March or early April, which is almost past when you should be dealing with the nutsedge. And your main issue with the Bermuda grass is during the summer. So that's your most effective time to dig it out and of course, to bury it if you're going to use some kind of mulch to smother. Arborist wood chips are great for this purpose. I've known a lot of people who will smother temporarily with a heavy-duty landscape fabric. If you exclude sunlight and prevent photosynthesis, very few plants can survive for very long without being able to photosynthesize. I will say, however, the Bermuda grass can come back from even a month or two being covered without any difficulty. If you want to smother it out, like using sheet mulching or any of the techniques you're seeing people use to kill their lawns, it really takes all summer in the case of Bermuda grass. And even still, I would monitor carefully the next spring, because what happens, you think you've killed it all out, you plant your whole new area, we go into the winter when Bermuda grass is dormant, and next April, you're not paying attention, and you just five or six little places pop up. That is a really easy time to control it. By August or September of that same year, it's running back in the whole area. So monitor carefully the second year after you take any, let's say, drastic measures to try and curtail it, such as sheet mulching.
So here's another thing that it's a good thing to put on your calendar, as to go and check the Bermuda grass, go and pull out the nutsedge. Yeah. No, it's like you've got a great calendar going, man.
When people ask about, they'll walk in and ask a question like, I've got a lot of weeds. What do I do to get rid of them? As if there's one magic bullet that's going to
first you figure out what you got.
Well, that's my first question. What are the weeds? And they give me this look like, oh, I didn't know there was going to be like a quiz. So, well, I'll do the quiz. You bring them in. I'll tell you what they are. That's no problem. But the reason I ask that question, there's three or four that are very difficult to control. Nutsedge, Bermuda grass, I'll call it morning glory, bindweed, field bindweed. Those are three of the most difficult ones to control because they're perennial. They're drought adapted in the case of Bermuda grass and bindweed. And those two, they're quite deep rooted as well. The nutsedge simply proliferates, but those are probably three of the most difficult. Whereas if you're just talking about, you know, the annual grasses and mustards and things that come up with the winter rains, totally different conversation. You can control those largely by mowing. Mowing not only doesn't control Bermuda grass, it encourages it because it takes away all the competition. So, you know, you can mow it if you want it to look better, but it certainly doesn't give any level of control. That's why we ask you what kind of weeds you're dealing with. There are three major periods of weed management. First of the winter rains, when those first things start coming up, early spring, when things like the nutsedge start coming up, and then the warm season weeds, which come up rapidly when the soil is, let's say, warm enough for planting tomatoes. That's an important time to start monitoring for subtropical plants like Bermuda grass and the fast-growing summer weeds like pigweed and some of the others that come up in your vegetable garden that don't sprout until the soil is warmer. So three main periods, beginning of the winter rains, beginning of spring by our standards, and summer weeds.
Well, Braden, that was a real long answer to a real short question.
Atlas nitrile coated gloves. There we go. I have another set of gloves by my door, which is a heavy leather glove that is way too cumbersome for doing handwork. But when you're picking up the piles of rose prunings, you need those. So if you're looking for gifts for your gardeners for this holiday season, nitrile coated gloves for day-to-day work and heavy leather gloves for moving piles of stuff.
Now, James wrote to us a few weeks ago, and Don read that email, and he said, "Whoa, I'm going to have to do some homework on this one." And he's finally finished his homework, done his reading, and is ready to talk about the subject. So, James, here we go. His message says, "Dear Lois and Don, thanks for all the wonderful information you provide. I want to ask about cold, moist stratification of California native perennial seeds. My understanding that this treatment in a refrigerator can often improve the likelihood of germination compared to sowing seeds outdoors in the fall. But I'm wondering a few things. One, what is the best way to go about it as a practical matter? For example, what substrates are best? Which of the many online sources should I trust about duration required, etc.? All tips are welcome. Number two, should I mimic the natural seasons, start stratification in late October, or is it better to give plants a longer first growing season by beginning stratification a month or two earlier? And three, I've been told that there are very few seeds are harmed by CMS, that's cold stratification. But is it better to give plants a longer first growing season by beginning stratification? Oops, I read that already. Okay. I've been told that these very few seeds are harmed by this, even if not all of them benefit much. Is this accurate? Can you recommend a procedure that will give a tolerable chance of success in cases where no reliable information about propagation exists?
And more to the point, is there any reliable information out there? And boy, the internet, it's a wild west when it comes to plant propagation of seeds.
Oh, yeah.
Way back when before I even opened a nursery, I worked in the Botanical Conservatory, as we call it now, the botany greenhouses on campus. And our job there was to maintain as broad and diverse a collection of plants from all over the world that might be of use to botany and horticulture professors, and more or less just grow as many different things as we possibly could. And this is before the internet, folks. So I would go and I would go find other botanical conservatories and gardens around the world and look at their lists of their accessions, just as we maintained. And I would write them a light letter on a manual typewriter that said we would be interested in the following items. And I would just send it off. And this was standard. We would get these letters ourselves. If you ever have propagation materials of these, we would be interested in them. And if there's anything you're interested in exchanging, we'll be happy to send you our accession list. And we would do this. Months later, a package would arrive from somewhere, Pakistan, India, someplace in Australia, who knows, from a botanical garden that I had written to with a bunch of seeds. That was all they could send. They wouldn't usually send other kinds of propagation stock. And we, of course, could do this legally. We could work with these types of organizations with all the phytosanitary certificates and whatnot. And then they would come. And I remember 50 years later opening these packages and going, now what? What do we do now?
It's seeds. What do we do?
Yeah. At least they have a botanical name, so that's a good starting point on the package. Now, what do we do? So we actually had a standard practice back then where we would take anything that we really cared about and split it into three or four groups of seeds. And one would go in for cold, moist stratification. One would go directly into pots on the warm bench. One would go onto the mist bench. Those are the three typical things we were doing. The mist bench would help to remove inhibitors in the seed coat and would make something sprout faster. Cold moist stratification, as it sounds, is where you put it in some kind of a medium and you put it in the refrigerator for X number of weeks before planting. We would pull out the books that we had that would have information about what plants might need. 9 times out of 10, the particular plant wasn't in there. And so we would just guess. And one of the ways we would guess is based on where that plant was native. All right. If it came from a high mountain or high latitude, we'd guess this probably needs cold, moist stratification. If it came from the subtropics or the tropics, we would guess it probably doesn't. It might even benefit from a warm bench. To one of your important questions, I don't think anything except maybe a truly fully tropical plant would be harmed by cold, moist stratification, because all you're doing is putting it in damp vermiculite or peat moss with sand, or just sand, or some people just do it on a paper towel in a plastic bag in your refrigerator. Your refrigerator is not freezing. It's 35 to 45 degrees, and that's the typical temperature used for cold, moist stratification. How long do you leave it there? Well, the references range from 1 month to 3 months, depending on what it is. And so 6 weeks seems to be a pretty average recommendation for cold, moist stratification. Vermiculite is particularly popular for this because it holds moisture, but also aerates. It isn't dense. Peat moss works well. Coir might work, but I would test it. And you just be aware that salinity can be a problem with coir, but it probably works about as well as peat moss. You don't want to keep them soggy. You don't want them to dry out. You just put them in the refrigerator. We do it in at our nursery when we're propagating things in plastic bags. Usually we poke holes in the bag so that there's some air exchange, and we put them in the refrigerator for about 6 weeks. And you do that anytime in the fall or even the midwinter. And generally that seems to be enough. You can have a lot of fun going online reading and about how particular plants are propagated. Some of them require, this is my favorite, cold, warm, cold stratification. Okay. Trillium is an example that I found needs cold stratification. Then you do warm stratification, where you put that seed somewhere for several more weeks or even months. And then you put it back through cold stratification, and then it germinates. So this is a plant that doesn't germinate until the second year after the seed falls on the ground. Why would a plant have that kind of adaptation to keep it from sprouting too early? So cold stratification is a way of mimicking what nature would do if the seed was just lying on the ground outside and getting covered by leaves from deciduous trees or something like that. It would be going into the winter with chilling, going through the winter under snow perhaps, and then warming up gradually in the spring and then germinating, not germinating in the fall while the soil is still warm and the seedling would be killed by the cold. So it's an adaptation that protects seedlings from winter injury, but you need to mimic that 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 week period, kind of depending on where it comes from. If the question is about California native plants, it gets really complicated. And James asked about certain species.
Calocortus, Fritillaria, Lilium, Allium, Delphinium, Asclepias, and Clematis.
Just two of those. I will show you the range of the information that's out there. Calocortus was hilarious to try and research for you.
What is Calocortus?
It's a bulb, Mariposa lily, and it's a very cool bulb. And there's native species, and there's native species up in the Pacific Northwest and all over the place. The Pacific Bulb Society has an entire section dedicated to the specific germination requirements of the genus Calocortus, and they're all over the map. And so that would be a case of trying to look at where it comes from and make a guess. But I did find that to be a very interesting read, even if it didn't really answer your question. Asclepias, milkweed, very, very popular. One of the reasons that common milkweed has become popular is it's easy to germinate. Many of the others, and tropical milkweed, is also very easy to germinate. So nurseries like those because they're easy to sprout. They can put them in 4-inch pots, put them out to sell, and it can happen all within the same season as other typical bedding plants or perennials. Many of the others have very, very specific germination requirements. And so that's one genus where you would just have to look it up and figure out which species you're dealing with. So just those two alone, I found that the range of information out there is daunting. And so you think, well, there's got to be a resource where people have compiled all this germination requirements of plants, whether it needs cold stratification or moist stratification. Well, to their credit, the Ontario Rock Garden and Hardy Plant Society, let's say that again, Ontario, as in Canada, not the one in Southern California, Ontario Rock Garden and Hardy Plant Society has a stunning list of 8,000 species that have been evaluated for whether they need cold stratification, warm stratification, cold, warm, cold stratification, scarification, which is a different conversation, and so forth. Not everything that you're interested in is on there, but 8,000 species is a pretty good starting point. So you can find that. Just search out the Ontario Rock Garden and Hardy Plant Society website and look for their germination guide. And there's also USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, has the Woody Plant Seed Manual, last updated in 2008. So the Woody Plant Seed Manual has tons of information about many woody plants from temperate zone climates, that is to say, colder climates than we have here. California natives, totally different issue. They're all over the place and can be very, very challenging to propagate. The one thing I took away from upper division courses in plant propagation, there is no single compendium of information then or now. And a lot of it is what we call trial and error and what they call empirical research, where you just keep trying different things, just as I was describing at the start of this long discussion, which is that we would try different things to see what worked. And if you have plenty of seed and you only get 5% germination, great. But if you paid $5 a seed and you've only got 5 of them, you probably want to look up more carefully what's out there. It's cold moist stratification is pretty simple. 6 weeks in vermiculite in a plastic bag in your refrigerator will do it. Starting anytime October through December would be fine, as long as you'll then be able to take it out and plant it in a place that stays warm enough. So if you have a greenhouse, cold moist stratification starting in October, You could plant in your greenhouse at the end of December, early January, when a lot of people are planting other things. You might have a warm pad or a heating element out there, or it might be a heated greenhouse. That'll be necessary at that point because the seedlings could be vulnerable to cold injury otherwise, even in a greenhouse, if it's just a passive greenhouse. So for a stratification of something that you're going to plant in the late winter, I would say November, December would be the time to start that stratification. But it doesn't hurt to leave them in there longer. 6 weeks is a good average, but 2 months is fine. So you can get going on this project now. Just be aware of what the special needs of that species might be once it's done with the stratification. One advantage of the paper towel method, where you just put them on, you don't enclose them in, but put them on a damp paper towel in a plastic bag, is you can see the seeds if they start to germinate. And some of them will do that right in the refrigerator. So if that starts to happen, you take those and you very gently put them into pots and grow them on. Vermiculite, peat moss, sand is a little harder to see what's going on. Other than that, those are probably the easiest way to go. And vermiculite is particularly popular for this, though it is hard to find. So if you can't find that, a mix of peat moss and sand is a very popular alternative.
And I want to come back to the Ontario rock garden.
Yeah.
If you can spell rock and garden and you put ON in front of it, onrockgarden.com,
there you go.
You go to their website and it is incredible. Yeah. I'm looking at it just as we're talking. They have so much stuff going on. And not only do they have in-person meetings, but they also have plant sales. They had seed exchanges. They have a newsletter that you can sign up for if you want to. I know Ontario's not California, but
yeah. Rock garden plants tend to have rather specialized propagation requirements. They're a very interesting group of plants. I mean, a rock garden is a term that you and I use, and we know what we're talking about. It typically refers to alpine plants that are being grown in rockeries, you know, which we don't have here. but it's a fascinating group of plants that tend to have rather specialized adaptations, and propagation of those plants can be difficult. For a good discussion of stratification, I found that gardenmyths.com, gardenmyths.com, not to be confused with the garden professor, Dr. Chalker Scott, who I refer to quite frequently, who's written books about garden myths. This is another gentleman who's just done a ton of research and brought a lot of information together. Gardenmyths.com. Great information about what is seed stratification. He has, according to his article, started over 2,000 species from seed. So this is just empirical research. And then you go to my old friend, Los Politas website. And this is a website devoted to a nursery, Los Politas Nursery, the owner of whom was a very, very knowledgeable native plant expert. And he's passed away, but the business is still going and they maintain their website. It is one of the most useful references for native plants that I've ever found. He challenges the common myths quite frequently based on his experience. And he does, this is what he says about plant propagation of native plants. Most newbies think that propagation is easy. And for non-natives, it generally is. For natives, though, they have triggers, usually multiple triggers that involve timing, mix, humidity, heat, and more. Remember your first computer? Remember how you were unimpressed about how little it would do and how much you had to do? Native plant propagation has some of those issues. I'd recommend you spend the least amount of time and money on the project as possible and see if you even like what the work entails. Bear in mind, this is a guy who made his living propagating and selling native plants. And if you can get anything to root and grow out, if you can get something to grow, then build the little propagation house and get all the expensive stuff you really need. If you're working very small scale, the pathogens have more trouble finding your plants. That's the key sentence I was getting at. As the operation gets bigger, the disease problems will escalate. Read, read, read. You'll need to read at least a few propagation books, a few websites. Maybe watch a video or go to a class. No, we do not offer one. Sorry, most of the YouTube videos are not done by knowledgeable folks. Most I'd give a 1 or 2 star rating. LasPolitas.com. But his sentence there, the pathogens have more trouble finding your plants. As the operation gets bigger, the disease problems will escalate. Everything about plant propagation requires as close to sterile environment and ingredients as possible. So you're using things like vermiculite, sand, perlite, peat moss, because they don't naturally make a habitat for pathogens. They're very low nutrition. They don't. It's difficult for Phytophthora, Pythium, Rhizoctonia, the big three seedling disease organisms, to get established in those media. So you don't have to sterilize them. They're basically kind of naturally sterile already. seed sometimes comes with those pathogens on them. So you need to have an environment that is not amenable to the spread of the water molds, is the group we're talking about. And when I was working in that botany greenhouse we were talking about earlier, one of the things we did was spray fungicides on the seed trays all the time. I mean, like every week or so. And that's a very common practice in greenhouses. But if you're doing it at home and you're using media that are basically sort of naturally sterile and you have pretty good airflow through the area, but you keep the plants adequately moist, then you probably won't have a problem with seedling diseases. Seedling diseases are very frustrating. You'll get a bunch of seedlings that come up and then they just start falling over and dying from Rhizoctonia, Pythium, or Phytophthora attacking them right at the soil level. And once it's in a flat or in a pot, it's going to wipe out everything in that flat and will happily jump to the next plot over. So if you do start propagating things from seed and you do start losing seedlings rapidly to this die-off, remove them immediately and don't use that pot again. Don't ever use that soil again. Never use the soil for propagation again for propagation. You can use it for other things, but not for propagating again. One of the standard practices when I was working in the botanical conservatory, every pot, no matter what, after it got used, got washed, rinsed in a 5% bleach solution as the last step. And then air dried after that. And that was to try and kill some of those pathogens. So it is challenging to grow many native plants from seed. And you just have to kind of do some trial and error on them. It can be fun to read about individual genera and species, but you will get a little overwhelmed with information. Stratification, pretty straightforward. That one I don't have too much trouble with. But bear in mind that the next stage, the growing on stage, is where things can go wrong.
I want to bring to your attention a club that I met up with 15 years ago because I was searching for a particular word and it happened to be in somebody's post on this forum and I got hooked. It's a wonderful club. It's called the Scottish Rock Garden Club and they got started in 1933. I didn't join them then, but it's been a long time. And they have a wonderful website. They have a forum where people can talk to each other and about lots of different things. And here's the URL for you. srgc.net. So Scottish Garden Club. Garden Club. SRGC. Got it. And not everybody can get to Davis. So when we announce things here that you can't get to, well, let me announce this one.
Scotland?
Scottish Rock Garden Club is having an event. It's having a garden show on this Saturday.
Okay, which city in Scotland are we at?
I have no idea. Hexham.
Okay, that sounds Hexham. Lovely. Rock garden plants are fascinating and learning how to propagate. The range of what you have to do to propagate nursery stock is phenomenal. And as he commented in the thing I read, a lot of people think it's easy. No, it's very complicated. Some plants require very high concentrations of hormone or they simply won't root. Many seeds require this kind of stratification. Just a couple of other things, scarification. Many California native, especially things in the legume family, lupins and things like that, have a hard seed coat that simply won't sprout until something triggers it to sprout, like fire. Or
that's why they're there. They're called lupin or wolf plant because after a fire goes through, they're one of the first plants that come back. People used to think that that was because they were wolf-like and they were, no, it's that they're very smart.
Lupins are very smart.
That as soon as they get burnt over, they go, oh yeah, time to do it. There won't be any competition here.
You can mimic scarification with fire. You can do that, but you can also just take those seeds and soak them overnight and that will soften the seed coat. So many seeds require that. And it's pretty easy to speculate which ones will. You can look at the seed and go, yeah, this is a hard seed coat, to either notch it, file it, or soak it in acid. That's something we would often do when I was, going through these processes. Weak acid solution, just try and basically loosen that seed coat a little bit or break it up a little bit. And there are some that simply won't germinate for a long time, no matter what. And so one of the things you learn when you're doing things from seed is just be patient. One of the simplest ways to deal with a plant that needs cold, moist stratification is to plant it in a pot at the beginning of the rainy season and put it outside where it'll get rained on and cold through the winter, and then it'll probably sprout in the spring. Just put it where that'll naturally get rained on. Remember, since we do have drought years here, like one just a few years ago, where we went the entire month of January without a single rainstorm, You do have to hand water if it doesn't actually rain, more or less according to our natural patterns. But just outside in the cold, we'll take care of it. That's basically mimicking what it would experience here. But if you're trying to grow something from a high elevation or a high latitude, you probably should cold moist stratify it. And back to your basic question, does it hurt anything? I can't think of a plant that seed that would be harmed by cold moist stratification.
What about the timing? That was his second question. Should he try and mimic the timing for that plant from where it is?
I guess. Basically, you should try different things. Now, this is really what it comes down to. If I'm sounding like it's a lot of trial and error, that's because it is a lot of trial and error. Let us know how it goes. That was a good list of plants because each one of them had unique germination requirements. Some are really easy. You know, we grow a lot of milkweed because milkweed has become incredibly popular for folks who are trying to encourage monarch butterflies. And they'll always tell you, wherever you're listening, you should plant the one that's native to your region. There's some discussion about whether that's accurate, but more to the point, wherever you're listening, it's a different species. And so you'll have to find out with your particular species, oh, look, this one requires warm, moist stratification, or this one just takes forever to germinate and you only get a 3% germination rate. Well, all right, get a lot of seed then, if that's the case. So you may find, this is one of the reasons I'm always a little concerned when new gardeners come in and want to buy a bunch of seed and start gardening that way. It can be fun. It can be really interesting to do. I highly recommend experimenting with it. But, you know, I have a vested interest in this, but going to a nursery and buying your tomato plant is probably an easier way to start your gardening experience. I had someone send me a note asking about how to grow apples from seed because her kid wanted to do it. Now, I know a lot of places, if you post that information online, everyone will jump in and go, don't grow apples from seed. You won't know what you're going to get, blah, blah, blah. Fine. Have them planted
from seed. It's an experiment.
Have them planted from seed. And it probably, I can't remember if apples seeds require cold stratification. Maybe they do. Maybe it'll just take a really long time to germinate. It's easy. It's fun. It'll be probably kind of like a Golden Delicious. Who knows? It'll be edible in any case. It's not like you get something totally inedible. And he will have grown the seed. He will have grown his own apple tree. He's only like 5 years old. So he can plant this thing. And 50 years from now, it'll probably still be there. Wouldn't that be amazing? So I don't discourage people from planting fruit trees from seed. I just want you to understand you're not going to get exactly what you're thinking. But in that particular case, it's pretty easy to do. A lot of people like to grow lemons from seed or citrus from seed of various types. With respect to that, if you're interested in that, send us a note. I have a chart that says which ones will and which ones will not come true from seed, meaning if you plant this true lemon like Eureka, you'll get a true lemon. If you plant Meyer lemon, you will not get a true lemon. It isn't a true lemon in the first place, and the seedlings are variable. So there's a whole massive chart someone has put together, and I have it saved. I can send it to you if you're interested, but more to the point, you ask about a particular mandarin, I can look it up and tell you whether growing it from seed is a worthwhile endeavor. It does take several years for a fruit tree from seed to finally fruit. So, you know, five-year-old kid, great. Teenager suddenly gets fruit on the tree he planted. That's a pretty cool thing to find out. But if you're planning on planting an orchard for your family, go on down to your nursery and buy an apple tree. Starting it from seed is definitely the slow way to go.
So we always end with a saying. Today I have two, and I don't know the author of either of them, but the first one is the glory of gardening, hands in the dirt, head in the sun, heart with nature. Now, this second one, this is just for you, Doug. This is specially picked this one out for you.
Uh-oh.
Gardening is not just a hobby. It's a way of life.
Did I say that?
No, but it describes you to a T.
There you go.
It is
your way. The sun is out. What am I doing indoors? There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.